This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
States are keenly aware of the issues. I think we've had this sort of wake-up moment with the Prague earthquake. And for folks that haven't experienced this in those central U.S. states, they have been made aware very quickly of this, and it's certainly a concern there.
Apparently, things are moving and shaking in Oklahoma. Literally. In the past 8 years, earthquakes in the Sooner State have increased from 2 a year to 2 a day. Is the expansion of gas and oil exploration during that same period of time a mere coincidence? Today on Sea Change Radio, I speak with Ole Kavan, a geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Kavan's area of expertise is human-induced seismicity, in other words, how human activity contributes to earthquakes. We talk about the work he's been doing studying the effects of carbon sequestration on seismic events, the sharp increase in Oklahoma's seismicity, and what the government and the public should know about how oil and gas industry practices could be making the earth move under our feet.
I feel the earth move under my feet.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend Ole Kavan. He's a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California. Ole, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Maybe you can tell us what you and your colleagues have been tasked with in trying to find links between what is known as induced seismicity, man-made earthquakes from natural gas and fracking.
Yeah, so the USGS's mission is to monitor seismicity, do basic science on earthquakes in our case, and figure out what is going on in certain locales. And in the central U.S., so Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas for the most part, Colorado is part of this too, the rate of seismicity or the number of earthquakes has increased significantly since about 2010. Oklahoma now has more earthquakes larger than magnitude 3 than California has, which is completely out of the norm. They used to have 2 or 3 or so, and they're on pace this year, I think, to have about 700 earthquakes that are larger than a 3.0.
How does that compare to California?
California has, I think, roughly 300 to 400 or so per year of 3 or larger. Of course, California has a history of much larger earthquakes at the higher end, like the 1906 earthquake, Loma Prieta in 89, and so on. Oklahoma has had the biggest event being a 5.7, and most of those are between 3 and 4, some are larger than 4 still, but they don't have the very large events that we see in California.
Is there the potential for these induced seismicity events to be of the magnitude of a 1906 earthquake, Ole?
That's a really good question, and it's really difficult to answer. For one, because the historic catalog, or the seismic catalog, is not well known across Oklahoma or Texas, say. And basically, that is the recurrence of large events is much larger there than if there is such a large event than it would be in California. So making these inferences is difficult. But what is sort of the ingredient to large earthquakes is the size of the fault that slips, or the area of the fault that slips in an earthquake, the amount it slips, and then the rigidity of the rock surrounding it. And so in California, of course, we see very large earthquakes. In Japan and Aleutians and so on, we see even larger earthquakes because the area of a fault is much bigger. In Oklahoma and Texas across the central U.S., it's difficult to say, for one, because we haven't seen any big ones, and we don't really know where the big faults are.
What about the New Madrid earthquake of, what, 1820, something like that? That was an aberration, but that was a fairly large event that paleogeologists can go back and look at now in a new light, perhaps.
Absolutely. The New Madrid zone has seen very large events, and I believe it was the 1870s. It was felt all across the central and eastern U.S., actually, but we don't have, of course, any instrumental records of it. So there's some debate on how large it was. There certainly is a history there of historic events from the paleogeologic record. And people, of course, have known about a seismic hazard in that area. So it isn't really so much related to the induced seismicity portion that we see across, you know, Oklahoma, Texas, and so states. So it's not really affected by that, and people know the seismic hazard and stay away from that zone.
So let's dive into the science behind the fracking and natural gas, which is causing these fissures to be created and this instability to exist.
It's interesting you bring up fracking as the cause for much of the seismicity. What actually is happening is that it's the wastewater disposal. Some of it is related to fracking, but in Oklahoma, for example, only 10% of the wastewater disposed comes from fracking.
So it's not actually the injection of the water. It's after the water gets put through these fissures, then they need to put it somewhere, and it gets re-injected into different chasms in the ground. Is that right?
Exactly. So with fracking, actually, the volumes of water injected are very small. What happens in fracking, long horizontal reach wells are drilled in hydrocarbon-bearing formations. Those are then fracked, meaning certain stages of the well are opened, high pressure, water is pumped in, fractures are generated right next to the well. And so far, the largest events associated directly with fracking in the U.S. are on the order of about 3. In Canada, they're a little bit bigger, about a 4. What then happens when you produce water and the water you use to make the fractures, that water is contaminated with all sorts of stuff. So you have to dispose it somewhere. And that disposal of wastewater, not just the fracking, but a number of other oil and gas operations, happens much deeper than the actual oil and gas-bearing formations. And oftentimes that wastewater is injected right above what's called crystalline basement. It forms more or less the sort of foundation of, for example, Oklahoma, Kansas, and so on. And above it is the sedimentary pack with formations that contain oil and gas. So this injection of wastewater and massive amounts of wastewater right above this basement is really the culprit to the induced seismicity of consequence, where you feel something at the surface, damages seen to structures, homes, and so on, and injuries may happen. Luckily, so far, I don't think anybody has been killed in one of the U.S.-based induced seismic events so far. And the cause, of course, is if you have a large fault that's close to ready to break in the basement, you inject water, water pressure permeates through, for one, the injection horizons where you dispose of your wastewater, but then the faults and fractures that reach into the basement where fluid can be transmitted, and more importantly, pore pressure can be transmitted. And those then can unclamp faults in the basement that are close to failure and cause these earthquakes that are of consequence, like the Prague earthquake in Oklahoma, Youngstown in Ohio, or Guy Greenbrier in Arkansas.
And what kind of size were those 3 earthquakes that you just mentioned?
Yeah, the Prague earthquake was the most significant one. That was a 5.7, so comparable to the South Napa earthquake we had here in California about a couple of years ago. The Youngstown, Ohio event was a 4.1, and the Guy Greenbrier, I think, was a 4.0. The difference of those is that they happen much shallower than most of the events, for example, in California, and that is because you have a pressure perturbation or a change in pressure, and you nucleate the earthquake much shallower than you would, for example, in California. So the effects felt at the surface are somewhat different in that you're closer to the source and you experience significant shaking right above it.
And this wastewater disposal that you're talking about, Ole, is that also the culprit to potential watershed pollution, or is that a different part of the process?
That's a different part of the process. The wastewater disposal is usually very deep, 6 to 9,000 feet or so in the case of Oklahoma. And it's insulated from the potable water resources, shallower, by a number of layers that are impermeable. So this wastewater disposal really has very little effect on the quality of drinking or potable water. What can happen, although I don't know of any cases, is that, for example, along the well itself, the well isn't cemented well, so it isn't closed to water flow up along the outside of the well, and that could potentially harm shallower aquifers.
So the seismicity events are being caused by a wastewater disposal issue, but a lot of what we've heard about the fears of methane and other chemicals seeping into the watershed and getting into people's water who live in an area where natural gas exploration is taking place, those are different processes, correct?
Yeah, so the processes of fracking hydrocarbon-bearing formations for oil and gas production happens much shallower. The water that's coming out of that and other oil and gas operations is injected much deeper, much below where that happens. And those areas are well insulated and well away from potable water aquifers. Thousands of feet, up to 5,000-6,000 feet difference between where you inject the water, wastewater, and where you then extract potable water for use. Well, I can't hope it.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Ole Kavan. He's a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey. Now, the oil and gas industry has been fighting environmental groups tooth and nail when it comes to defending the processes that could potentially harm people's drinking water. Has there been similar pushback from the industry when it comes to the wastewater disposal and the link with induced seismicity?
That's a really good question. Most of the folks we deal with, for example, in oil and gas industry are geophysicists, geologists as well, and they know the processes very well also. The problem we usually have is proving causality, and the problem of making an earthquake and all the ingredients that go into it are very complicated and poorly understood.
One of the holy grails of your business is to predict them, and we've gotten like a few seconds here or there, but you're still behind cattle when it comes to trying to figure out when something's going to occur, right?
Right. Well, anybody that usually claims to predict earthquakes, we more or less call a quack, and for good reason. There have been attempts to do it, and actually those were related to injection of wastewater at the Rangeley experiment in Colorado in the 60s and 70s. However, that has never been able to be, that never was able to be reproduced. So prediction is really not something that earthquake scientists do. And in fact, we think it's actually counterproductive, because even if you knew when an earthquake happened at a certain place at a certain time, you wouldn't really save people all that much. They may have the chance to evacuate or not. What we focus on is trying to understand how significant shaking and potential damage to structures can be at a certain place, and what the chances are of that shaking to take place over extended periods of times. That then allows building codes to be adjusted and buildings to be constructed in a way that they're safe in the event of an earthquake, whenever that may happen. And so we focus at the USGS mostly on those types of issues, because we feel that that actually protects lives much more effectively than predicting an earthquake at a certain time.
So Ole, what would be some of the end results of your findings if indeed there is this link between earthquakes and natural gas and fracking?
Yeah, so some of the findings we have so far is that, again, it's the wastewater disposal, some of which comes from fracking. Actually, in Oklahoma, only 10% of the wastewater that's disposed comes from fracking. The rest comes from other sort of secondary oil recovery or enhanced oil recovery. These are water flooding or dewatering types of techniques that have been around for a while, but haven't been applied as much in the past. And so that's one of the findings. One, that fracking isn't the main culprit, or the direct culprit at least, of the significant earthquakes induced across the central U.S. It is the wastewater disposal. From a scientific perspective, what we found is that it's quite interesting in how fluids actually communicate pore pressure underground. And it's not in a simple way that you'd think fluids diffuse out, or pore pressure diffuses out across a very homogeneous medium. It happens through faults and fractures that are pre-existing. And the big challenge is that we don't know where those large faults are that are potentially primed for a significant earthquake. And there currently aren't any imaging techniques to really locate those. So the only thing that is a proven technique to locate earthquakes is to actually find seismicity. So finding very small earthquakes prior to a large event and being able to delineate where large faults are is probably sort of the main research focus that we have now on developing better techniques, better technology to find small earthquakes, better computational methods to go through all the data and find those. So it's been actually a very interesting process, in that we have the sort of perturbation that takes place that makes earthquakes happen sooner than they otherwise would have. And so it's been really interesting in, for one, figuring out the basic science: how do you get fluids, how do they flow underground, and how do they eventually create earthquakes or don't create earthquakes, or help in creating earthquakes. And then the technology portion on the other end: how do we improve our monitoring capabilities of finding smaller events, finding fault systems that may be primed for earthquakes down the road?
Well, outside of the actions of the U.S. Geological Survey, what are some of the ways that we might be able to mitigate these induced seismicity events, if that is the goal? You mentioned trying to change the building codes accordingly, but I assume there's also some value in looking at other ways of disposing this wastewater than just injecting it into the ground. What are some of the paths that the industry and regulatory agencies are looking at to try to minimize the impact of these events?
Yeah, there are a number of ways, and these are taken not just by us or regulators. The oil industry, of course, is also just as interested in mitigating or not causing any of these in the first place. So the first point, of course, is stay away from where you know faults are. And so with that comes knowing where they are, finding them, and so on. And that's been done, and we're trying to find smaller earthquakes that may delineate where those are. Secondly, a lot of the disposal of this wastewater has happened right above this crystalline basement where some of these larger faults are that could cause earthquakes. And now the move has actually gone in industry to try to dispose the water somewhat more shallow and hopefully find a formation that is insulated from the basement. So you have a low permeability rock, for example, where fluids cannot permeate through as easily. And therefore, pore pressures also aren't communicated into the basement as much. So industry has taken that in certain cases into account and trying to dispose of this water more shallowly than they did in the past.
So do we need a big earthquake to act on this? Or are these induced events that we're having enough for the government to put real funds behind it, to try to enact different building codes, to try to look for alternative ways for wastewater disposal? Or do we need a big event to really kind of wake us all up?
Yeah, I think that big event that was a wake-up call for state legislators, industry, and so on has happened already with the Prague earthquake of 5.7 in 2011. After that, states like Oklahoma and Kansas and Texas have taken significant steps to increase funding for the state geological surveys, to contract, for example, the U.S. Geological Survey to do their assessments as well. And so states know that is a problem, and 5.7 can cause significant damage. Luckily, nobody got seriously hurt or killed in that earthquake, but it definitely is something that gets people's attention and makes people do certain things. In Kansas, for example, much like it has also happened in Oklahoma and Texas, seismic networks have been improved using state funding. But the Kansas legislation also decided to have zones of reduced injection of wastewater, for example, to try to mitigate the number of earthquakes that were taking place there. And that seems to have helped in reducing the number of earthquakes. So states are keenly aware of the issues. I think we've had this sort of wake-up moment with the Prague earthquake. And for folks that haven't experienced this in those central U.S. states, they have been made aware very quickly of this, and it's certainly a concern there.
I can imagine some 60, 70-year-old person who's lived their whole life in Oklahoma is now, you said they have two or three small seismic events in the state before the oil and gas industry began exploring there, and now they're having 600 or 700, did you say?
600 or 700, yeah, I believe it was 700 in 2015.
I mean, so the landscape for earthquakes is changed significantly there, to say the least.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And of course, owing to their seismic history, their building codes and their ways of building homes is completely different and not well suited. Brick construction that isn't very elastic in the event of shaking. And you certainly build for probably other natural hazards like tornadoes and so on, which are completely different than how you would build in earthquake country like we do in California. So folks are concerned, and they should be concerned, because it can be dangerous, and especially those types of structures that folks live in there for the most part.
And do you miss me like I miss you? 'Cause I'm digging myself a hole, digging myself a hole, digging myself a hole, and I'm sinking down. I gotta find that place where the devil can't be found, and get that cold, clear water from that hole in the ground. I need that cold, clear water from that hole in the ground. Mama, I'm so dry.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Ole Kavan. He's a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey. So we've been talking about how man is causing earthquakes, these smaller earthquakes, from the wastewater disposal process in natural gas and fracturing. One of the things that the coal industry has been promising for quite some time is that the clean coal holy grail is coming, and that's because of CO2 sequestration, just injecting carbon dioxide into the earth. That's something that you and your colleagues are studying as well. Have you determined whether this is safe science or not?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Currently, there's one demonstration site in the U.S. that does it at a sort of industrial scale, how it would have to be applied if it really were to make a dent in our greenhouse gas budgets. And that's in Decatur, Illinois. At Decatur, Illinois, you have a confluence of a number of factors. For one, across the Illinois basin, you have a lot of point sources of CO2 emitters. These are corn ethanol plants, coal-fired power plants, and so on. And at this Decatur side, ADM, Archer Daniels Midland, is a corn ethanol producer, and one of their byproducts is CO2. The CO2 is injected, much like it is across Oklahoma with wastewater, into deep sedimentary formations that have enough pore space to accommodate significant amounts of CO2. They're also located right above crystalline basement. So the potential exists that you encounter a fault that's primed for failure. That hasn't happened at Decatur. The biggest earthquake we've seen there is a 1.0, so nobody felt it at the surface, and we had to look pretty hard through our seismic records to find it. But if this were to be applied across, say, the entire Illinois basin, which more or less encompasses all of Illinois, or at least central and southern Illinois and neighboring states, you'd have a lot of those sources where you inject CO2. You may eventually increase pore pressures enough and encounter a large fault that the induced seismicity hazard is certainly there. Again, much like Oklahoma and Texas, if you inject just about everywhere in the state, you're going to find an earthquake, or you're going to find a fault that causes an earthquake, and we've seen that happen. So the same physical mechanisms are at play in this, but we've learned quite a significant amount about how to inject it and how to inject it well. The one factor that really aids in maybe mitigating the hazard is that CO2 is more buoyant than the water, or the water contained in the pores where you inject it. And so you may not actually communicate pore pressure into the basement as much as you would with wastewater. So that may be a mitigating factor in this process. But a lot of the other ingredients are very similar to wastewater disposal.
Comparing the two, the wastewater and the CO2, a little bit more over a longer period of time, we've had like a decade plus of oil and gas exploration in middle of America and this wastewater process. As you just mentioned, the CO2 sequestration is still very much in its infancy stage. What kind of long-term sustainability is there, in your view, with both of these processes going 50, 60 years in the future? Can the ground support decades and decades of pumping water and CO2 into it?
I can speak more to the CO2 portion because that's an active part of my research. And there, if you were to inject for about 50 years across the Illinois Basin, there were a couple modeling studies and tried to predict or estimate the increases in pore pressure. Those increases are significant, but again, owing to some of the physical properties of CO2 itself being buoyant and not maybe dropping down into the crystalline basement, may aid in actually reducing the seismic hazard associated with it. With wastewater, wastewater disposal has been going on in oil and gas extraction, of course, for the last, I don't know, century, maybe more or so, especially across Oklahoma and Texas. What's changed there is that the cut of oil to gas has changed. So in the past, you had a significant portion of water, but now you have 90 to 95% water that comes out and a very small portion of oil, or even smaller portions of oil. So the amount of wastewater produced in shallower layers that has to be disposed deeper is significant.
That's similar to what we're seeing in the largest oil fields in Saudi Arabia, right?
Right. Right. So the cuts there, I don't know what exactly the cuts in those fields are. I think they're somewhat higher. But eventually, of course, you probably hit an economic boundary more than you hit a natural boundary, that it just isn't economical anymore to pump that much water and out to get a little bit of oil and pump the rest back in. And I'm not an economist, so I don't know what that threshold is. But in general, earthquakes can happen just about anywhere because the crust is critically stressed, so there's significant forces acting on it. And if you have one event, you release some of that stress that's built up in the crust, and if you inject more water and you allow more forces more or less to act on it, then you can accelerate that process. So it's not like we would see a much different type of seismicity if we were to continue oil and gas operations as they are now across the central U.S.
He's a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey, Ole Kavan. Ole, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Carol King, Elton John, and Mark Stone. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.